We okay. I think I have an intro I want to do for this one, so give me a sec.
Hello, and welcome to your interactive podcast system. This is a new system. It's very special, and wait, hang on. Full start. Okay, fellas. Hello and welcome to Gamer once again, the show that has many intros, many bits, no false starts, always just careens right through the barrier directly into your iPod, which you're definitely listening to this through.
Mm-hmm.
I hear that's how podcasts get their name. How are we doing today, David? How has your week in gaming gone?
My knee is very sore at the moment.
Gamer problems.
Gaming problems. Knee and back pain. I'm getting old. I finished Je Sens, which is good. The last kind of third of the game's really, really kind of challenging in a fun way, in a really kind of tangible way. I've also been playing the Spyro remaster that Toys for Bob developed. And that's Spyro.
Yes. Yeah. Did anything in particular spur that on? Because I know there was a rumor a couple weeks back that Toys for Bob were like closing, but then I think they were just moving offices.
I'll tell you what spurred it on. Every time I turn on my Steam Deck, it downloads new stuff for it. So I said, look, I need to play this before I go mad having to sit through like three or four different shader updates for Spyro the Dragon Collection. But you know, worst excuses. I've also been playing. I was going to play for a segment. I was going to do this thing where I played this game called Let's Make a Soccer Team.
Oh yes.
And
okay.
I was going to do the whole thing. Like, how can I meet the? Can I get to like the top of the food chain in the game before I get like kicked off the game? And it just wasn't interesting. Let's Make a Soccer Team PS2 game, developed by Smilebit, who are the people
Sega
behind
Studio.
The Jets. Yeah, Jet Set Radio and stuff.
Yeah.
It's the only entry in the series called, and apologies if I, you know, Pro Soccer Club Osukuru, which is it's like the only entry in that series to be localized here.
Mm.
And it's a really weird game because it's like you play as like the owner of like a team that you take over a team in like either England, not either, but in like England, Spain, France, Italy, or Holland, I think. Sorry, the Netherlands. And you basically can like rename the team. You're meant to like, it's meant to be like you're just like the kind of, you know, director of football, but you manage the team as well at times for some reason. But it's just not interesting. It's just one of those sims where, like, you know, you play a game and then you go for like 3 days and then you play another game and you go for it's not interesting. It's not an interesting game to talk about. It was something I was jealous of growing up because my friend had a copy and he was like, this is the best game ever made. You like make a team and you go out and you gain glory, you gain the championship. And I was like, wow,
yeah,
that's so cool. And I got it, and it's a testament to like how incapable I was of playing those kind of games growing up. I got it and I played it for like a day and I was like, I can't tack this, so I just never went back. But you know, other than that, it's been kind of quiet. I spent a sizable amount of time playing stuff for this week, but other than that, nothing much. How about you?
So I put Legends Arceus to one side for a bit because somehow I completely forgot that Arzette, the Jewel of Faramir, was coming out the day after we recorded Valentine's Day, which has been very fun. I've been very excited for this game, like since the actual moment they announced it. I think. Mm-hmm. You guys in the pod to service saw my reaction in real time when I just went on Twitter one night and it was like, first thing I saw was the Gex Remaster trilogy. I was like, oh, huh? Okay, what? I thought those guys got embraced. Like, I thought Crystal Dynamics or something had got bought, or like the Tomb Raider IP or something had been bought by Embracer. I think it's with Amazon, unless I'm thinking of...
Yeah, Amazon bought like the rights to like everything, like movies, TV shows, games for Tomb Raider.
But no. Somehow Gex still has some like level of independence, or is with Square Enix in some capacity. So I saw that first. I was like, well, that's a weird announcement. then I saw the announcement of the Lost Shantae game on GBA, which was like a concept that had been like sort of shopped around, but nobody really wanted to publish it because the original Shantae game on Game Boy Color sold terribly. It came out very late. Capcom didn't really give it much of a print run because they didn't have a huge amount of confidence in it, and then it bombed. And then obviously the series didn't come back till the DSiWare game. So that was also like, whoa, okay, that was, I felt like that was going to come back at some point, but not in such a huge form. And then I saw this game, Arzette, which immediately caught my eye because it has these very striking cutscenes in the style of the Zelda CDI games, which I will get onto in like my main segment. I'm fairly certain everyone listening like knows the backstory and stuff, but there were some fun bits that I found while I was doing research. I also got very enamored with the CDI. I spent a lot of time reading CDI magazine over this last week. The UK publication, if you go on archive.org, you can find pretty much every issue, which I love when like magazine publishers are cool and they just let old out of print magazines that they are never going to make a profit from ever again, they just allow it to exist online in some capacity, whether it's through archive or that there's like retromags.com or .co.uk. Because sometimes Future put through like strikes on some of the old Nintendo ones, and it's like, you're not doing anything with it though. If you were like still selling it digitally, you know, if you were selling PDFs for like £3 or something, then fair enough. But like, especially knowing the effort that goes into scanning these things, it's just like, just let the sleeping dogs lie, okay? So because nobody really has a vested interest in keeping CDI magazine out of the hands of the people I've been reading through that, I'm trying to think if there are any sort of stray thoughts that wouldn't belong in the main section through there. There were a few screenshots I sent through to you guys. I think one of my favorites was the little bit, the box out where they were talking about Mad Dog McCree, which we'll definitely talk about somewhere further down the road. I was saying this to David in the DMs when I like opened this book and was like, oh, I'm going to talk a little bit about the development of the Zelda CDI games. I was overwhelmed with all the opportunities that presented themselves. And now I think I have about at least 3 different episodes worth of material. But yeah, there was a box out about Mad Dog McCree and it was all like, oh yeah, it's got over 36 minutes of video footage. And the developer says it's going to be 15 to 20 hours of gameplay. And you look at that and you're like, that's quite impressive, you know, 36 minutes of cutscenes, that's quite good for a game from 1993. And then you think about it some more and you think about the fact that Mad Dog is entirely an FMV game, so that's actually the entirety of the gameplay unspooled. And if it's supposed to be 15 to 20 hours of gameplay, you are going to just be seeing the same clips over and over. That was a very generous figure as well. There was another one about one of the later Zelda CDI games, which is made by a different developer, Zelda's Adventure. It all has like live action actors rather than the weird animated cutscenes. There was a bit mentioned in there where they were like, it has over 200 characters to interact with and it has thousands of environments and stuff, and it was like, that's not true. I don't know what numbers they fiddled to like inflate the numbers, but it was a lot of hype going on. So they mentioned there was this big box out of Mad Dog. They mentioned all about that. Then the second one was like, there's also going to be this game about this magician who does magic tricks on your CDI and he makes cards disappear and stuff. I'm trying to remember what the name of it was. It was very funny because it was like them essentially being like, shell out like £30 for basically a video of a magician. Why not? And then the third one was just so resigned. It was just a single sentence that said, they're also working on a version of Hangman. Was it? I forget what the game was even called. It was like Enforcer or something. They're like, it's essentially a version of Hangman. And it was just all lowercase at that point. Like, they were just like, look, you just have to fill the sentence, okay? Not everyone's going to be a banger. But yeah, I had a lot of fun reading through that in addition to playing through Arzette itself. I just rolled credits a couple hours before we started recording on this, and it was a blast. I was really worried they might not pull it through, but it's the kind of adventure game that I just really enjoy, where it doesn't really put up too much of a fight. It's pretty easy to get through, and when you die, it's like pretty much a slap on the wrist. You just go back to the start of a segment. The main joy of it is sort of, it's very much the journey, and it's also finding out what items to give to what characters, and also seeing which cutscenes to trigger next. I usually play a lot of games on my Switch Lite nowadays because I find it a lot more comfortable to hold. But I went straight over to my original Switch because A, it feels right playing it with that like janky Joy-Con D-pad, given that the CDI has such a weird controller. And B, I just needed it to be on the biggest screen possible. I was very much thinking about David Lynch being all like, all these teens looking at movies on their fucking phones. They don't know. It needs to be on the biggest screen possible. So I very much went in that vein. There's not a huge amount else I want to say about it because I don't want to spoil. I don't want to just like recount what's in the cutscenes and stuff. But it has a lot of them. It's got about... This game also has about 30 or 40 minutes of cutscenes, but thankfully that's not the entire game. It's all spread out quite nicely. Quite short as well, quite brisk. I rolled about 4 hours in it by the time I got to the credits, although the in-game timer doesn't count like cutscenes and menus and stuff like that. So I think my actual play time is closer to 5 or 6 hours, which is a great game length to me. Like Luigi's Mansion is 6 hours, and that's like, that's great. I love it when I can get into a game, be done with it in a week. If I want to go back and like 100% it, I totally can. But if I could just mainline it in that time, I often end up quite happy. So I do find it funny that you bounced off the football game you were on, because I know you're quite a football manager head. Like, I'm always curious about like, yeah. I don't want to like sound cynical or like interrogate it, but I am always curious like what the appeal is. Is it like, do you get in like a sort of zen state moving stuff about, or is it the feeling of progression? Like,
it's a kind of a mix of the innate primal urge to be victorious in life and the ability to do funny things with players, such as I've seen so many things online where people have like, there was one where this guy really hated Sergio Aguero, who's his Man City, used to play for Man City, he's retired now. So he took over Man City. He banned Aguero from being able to train or play, put him into the reserve team, and blocked any offers for him.
Right.
So he like regressed to like the worst player in the game from like the best player in the game.
I never thought of also, it from that angle. Yeah. Like the sort of role play. Just,
yeah. The role play aspect, but also it's just like it's a good like podcast game, you know. It's easy just to put it on and be like, okay, I can get mad at like this digital person and listen to like whatever, you know, the podcast.
Yeah, the
whatever,
podcast, you know? I don't listen to podcasts myself, much too pretentious.
Oh, <yeah.
laughs> I give it a miss. As I was alluding to in the first section, the CDI rabbit hole opened before me, and it was glorious. So you might be wondering what the CDI actually is. And I think a lot of people have an idea of what it is, but I was quite surprised by like sort of what I found about it. So it's really hard to like structure this in a way that's not like, well, actually, but it's like, I looked into it, and it's very connected with the general development of the CD format. Like, you sort of look at it and you think it might be kind of an afterthought or an addition, but it was actually one of those things that was being developed, like, sort of from the start of the format. There's a whole history with CD where they have this sort of Rainbow Books format. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. It's a very strange sort of system that they developed. So in 1980... Philips and Sony co-develop the original CD, and they call it the Red Book standard. So it's like Red Book audio. I know. And this is the weird thing. They call it the Red Book because they put it in a literal red book.
Mm.
But nobody knows, like, why they put it in a red book to begin with. It's just, I guess it's just like, you know, they put it in a folder and then they're like, yes, this is the Red Book stamp.
The Red Book.
And then from then on, they do the Yellow Book, which is CD-ROM. They go on to the Orange Book for CDR. So they're sort of like going along the rainbow. They do the Beige Book, which is for photo CD, which is like, it's not, I did find out, it's not just, I do want to just say, oh, it's just JPEGs on a CD. It is like raw files, but it's 1992 file compression. You can't expect too much from it. I just love that it's the Beige Book. It's like, look, this is the it's photo CD. Okay, you're not going to be that excited about it. It's just, CDs can store a lot of data. Here's 100 photos on a CD. And then it goes all the way up to the Purple Book, which is the double density CD format that basically went nowhere because DVD was already about.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 2000. So that's about 20 years worth of development with just like CD tech. The CDI format is the Green Book, which was developed in 1986. And Panasonic or Matsushita also like sort of hopped on at one stage. What's particularly interesting is that sort of through quantum entanglement, Nintendo would get involved with all three of these companies. Like Philips and Sony's involvement will become very clear very soon, but Panasonic would be the guys that would develop the GameCube disc. I don't know who they partnered with for like the Wii onwards, but it is like a weird proprietary like DVD format. And then I have no idea what happened with Wii U because it's like kind of Blu-ray, but not, because I don't think they're paying a license to Sony or something. I think they just sent a guy into a factory and we're just like, we're gonna invent our own thing, and then it just ends up being Blu-ray again. No clue. Fun thing as well is that there's actually never been a Nintendo system that can play CDs. The first Wiis that came off the production line can play DVDs if you like use homebrew to hack them, and then eventually they took the chips out. But there's never been a single Nintendo system that can play a CD. They can play their own proprietary discs. Some Wiis can play DVDs. None of them can play CDs. So yes, the CDI is the Green Book format. And although it was developed in 1986, it took until 1990 before Philips brought the first like CDI players to market. The very first players cost $1,000, so about $2,500 in today's money.
Oh,
it did eventually get cut to, funnily enough, $599. the famous the Ridge Racer, the amount that Sony announced the PS3 at, you know, 15 years later and would laughed off stage about. It's worth noting, of course, that when CDI was being developed, it wasn't as a games format first. It was like sort of a multimedia thing. It was a storage thing. The interactive aspect was with like educational use in mind. So a lot of the early software is like encyclopedias, kids counting games and stuff like that. And it's, you know, sort of mostly at a time when computers are limited to like educational institutes, like universities. And it's also worth noting that it was sort of pitched as like this multimedia all-in-one thing for the TV, which, you know, Microsoft echoed many years later with Xbox One. Mm-hmm. It's why I'm actually quite upset RZ doesn't have an Xbox One version. It's got a Series version. It's got a PS4 version. But there's no Xbox One version because it would just feel so right to slide that disc into a VCR Xbox One. It would just be like all the eras combining. But not to be, unfortunately. So, yes, it continues on from there as a multimedia system. It has some appeal for Europe for a time. They tried to reinvent it a few times by like introducing video CD as well. There was one of the reviews I was looking at in the CDI magazine was talking about When Harry Met Sally, and they're giving this really great review of the film and talking about the directors and talking about the cinematography, the script. They're like, yeah, it's, you know, you laugh, you cry, it's everything you want in a movie. And then in the last like sentence, they're like, but we have to give it one star because the encoding is terrible. Like it, everything's like really dark. And then when the scenes change, all the lights like blow out for like 2 seconds and everyone's skin is like glowing radioactive white. So they're like, yeah, great movie, terrible version, like just buy the tape. So yeah, they have like mixed success with the video CD format, but then video CD becomes more widely available, more computers come out that are cheaper as well. And then, you know, eventually there's DVD and stuff like that. There is, interestingly, the wrinkle that, like, the CDI was apparently always built to accept a high-speed phone line. So quite near the end of its life in 1996, you could actually hook it up to the internet and, like, browse Usenet and, like, check your emails for your TV. The official CDI magazine is, like, constantly warning you about going on basically unmoderated forums, though. They're like, be careful, like, all the kids are saying you should avoid, you shouldn't get flamed, which they define as getting sent abusive emails, which is so, oh, just so precious. Like, yes, great interpretation of that term.
Opening hate mail on your CDI and seething as you have to, like, cycle through with that remote. Like, this, like, slowly yeah. going through, like, an email. Like...
And those freaks with the, like, Saturn modem are, like, typing furiously at you. Someone on a Commodore 64 BBS is, like, the console wars are raging, basically. God, I should totally... I have found, you can find old Usenet stuff still online, ravenously defending the Atari Lynx against the Game Boy. And, you know, it was all the talking points. It was like, yeah, it's a big console, but, like, it's a beast and it has all this power. And, like, the Game Boy could never run games like this. And people are just like, yeah, but it's just more fun. And it's like, a quarter the price. The guy's, like, raging. I would love to go on, like, a little rabbit hole because I find it fascinating that stuff's still available online. But yeah, the CDI format goes on, it winds down, Philips essentially abandon it in 1996, and then the last players get discontinued in 1998. But in the middle of all that, while they're sort of flailing, figuring out the multimedia aspect, there's a sort of emerging market in FMV games. So as I kind of alluded to with video CD, with CDs you can store a lot more data than you ever could on a ROM cartridge. So developers are figuring out, oh, we can make the most realistic looking games ever by filming people, and it's like, look how real the graphics are, it looks like a real person, because it's filmed footage. There are some interesting examples of this being done, like, prior to the CD format. There's the Action Max, which I never remember if that actually came out or not. Like, it's one of those consoles and systems that's so rare that people kind of debate how wide of a release it got. But it was essentially this VHS-based game system that was revolved around light gun games, essentially. It couldn't really respond to what you were doing. It just had, like, a score counter at the top. And then you'd fire at the signals on the TV, and then the gun would register when you'd fired, and then at the end of the game, you'd have your score. But with CDs, they could actually make it dynamic so that, you know, when you fire at people, they'd actually react, and it would play different clips and stuff. So this market was emerging, and it was doing quite well for itself, because even though Philips were selling these quite prestigious, quite good for their time, encyclopedia software, stuff like Compton's Interactive Encyclopedia, they were very expensive. They were like £300. And it wasn't the kind of stuff that was, like, wowing consumers. It was just, like, a nice convenience if you already had the system. But games were able to be developed at much smaller budgets, much faster turnaround times, and they'd just be much more profitable even with, like, the niche market. So around about 1991, 1992, Philips are like, okay. So they start delegating a small team, and they get them to start working on games. Meanwhile, in the background, Sony is taking notice of, like, sort of the rise of the CD-ROM. And obviously, as they have a vested interest in having developed the CD format, they're rubbing their hands. They're going, ooh, the royalties we can get off CDs. Ooh, okay. So they start making their own moves into games. And they reach out to Nintendo and they start collaborating. The whole story of the Nintendo PlayStation is very well documented. It's kind of incredible, actually. I hadn't heard about the story until around about 2010 when I read about it in O&M. And it exploded my mind, because I thought Sony and Nintendo had just been in parallel for so long. And I didn't realize there was this collaboration early on. But yeah, it starts out around about 1990-1991. They're talking about developing a system together. This is after Sony have already developed the sound chip for the SNES as well. They also do a little bit of publishing through their arm, Sony ImageSoft. They don't do much of note. The main things are like they do the Hook game on like pretty much every platform, which has like an absolutely horrific Robin Williams like caricature in it. Like the NES version's this horrible bobblehead. And again, as I was saying with the James Bond one, you just look at it for 2 seconds, you're like, this, someone in Europe made this. It's just like, it just has that feel, that aura. They also, there was like some SNES RPGs. They did Mickey Mania as well. They published that. But, you know, they see the money coming in from that as well. And they're like, okay, cool. This is exciting. Obviously, Sega are developing the Sega CD as well. Hudson are doing CD stuff for the TurboGrafx. It's all, everyone's turning to CDs. So Sony feel like it's going really well, but they apparently overstepped the mark when they proposed to Nintendo that Nintendo keeps the royalties on cartridge games, but Sony keep the royalties on discs. And Nintendo was seeing that discs are going to be overtaking cartridges because they're much cheaper to produce. Load times are an issue, but if, you know, your system can cache enough memory, it doesn't matter too much. And yeah, it's much cheaper. Much cheaper, much more storage. Those are like the bottom line things. And they start getting worried about this, and they're like, no, you're not taking all our money. And, you know, they keep fighting about this, but Sony remains optimistic. And at CES in 1991, they make a big announcement. They show off the prototype. They're like, this is the PlayStation. This is the CD revision of the Super Nintendo. You know, we're working on it with our partners. We're quite excited for it. The very next day, Nintendo put out a press statement saying, we're not working with Sony. We're actually working with Philips because they know the CDI format well. And we feel like they'd be a good match for us. And Sony get completely blindsided like this. Like, they're understandably very embarrassed because they have multiple prototypes. Like, they've been demoing it on a massive show floor. So, you know, they come to blows over that. There's a whole really interesting story with Sony where already, like, Ken Kutaragi and co. had been, like, up against the big wigs at Sony that think games are, you know, there's no value in them, and they've already been working kind of in secret, and then when this Nintendo stuff falls through, they're, you know, about to fire the entire team. And then they're like, yeah, but don't you want to just stick it to Nintendo? And then that's the point where, like, sort of the guys at Sony, like, tent their fingers, and they're like, go on, do it. Like, you have our blessing. The interesting thing as well is that in Philips, it was a similar sort of feeling where I think a lot of the execs were quite embarrassed by how much they've been spending on this encyclopedia software, and the games guys were kind of undermining that. So again, their games team was like quite small off to the side, and then it sort of eventually took over more of the interactive media side of the company as the game sort of bore more fruit. Nintendo's efforts with Philips didn't go anywhere. I don't think they even announced any hardware. They just said, oh, we're working with Philips on a CD thing, and then nothing really happened. But as a result of this, Philips were granted the license to use Nintendo characters for their own projects. The legend is that it's like, and I know I say the legend, but it's like, it's because it's like a couple of sources are people that are unfortunately no longer with us. And it's hard to corroborate this stuff because if you talk to Nintendo about this, they slam the door on your face. Mm-hmm. You talk to Philips, nobody working there now, like, really cares. You know, they're going to be like, well, do you want to talk about our washing machines or like our light bulbs? Why do you want to talk about like this random like multimedia thing we did like 30 years ago? So hard to find much of a consensus, but the legend is that it's like 5 Nintendo characters, and we know it's like sort of Mario, Link, Zelda. Apparently they were working on a Donkey Kong game at some point. No clue what that would have been like.
Hellish.
It would not have been good. It probably would have been just some weird remake of the arcade game. And bear in mind, this is before Donkey Kong Country as well. Mm. So like, who knows? It would have just been like the weird like Saturday Supercade cartoons where it's just a Popeye knockoff or whatever. I do love thinking about like what that fifth thing might have been. If it was like, were they like seriously looking at Metroid or like Kid Icarus or just like, or something really weird. And they weren't able to get around to it. But we'll probably never know. But yeah, so they start out on this Nintendo Quest in earnest. They reach out to a studio called Animation Magic. This is a studio that's founded by a guy called Dale DeSharon, who's an American primary school teacher, and this guy called Igor Razbov, who's like this Russian entrepreneur who's like absolutely going for it. Like, the moment the Soviet Union falls, he's over in America, he's making deals, he's like really eagerly chasing the emerging software market. So they make this studio together called Animation Magic, and sort of the idea is that they can outsource to Russia because there's a lot of artists there that are excited to, excited in some ways to take advantage of the emerging market in games, and also quite terrified by what the fall of the Soviet Union means for society, really. Mm-hmm. Very complicated set of scenarios. It's hard to find a lot of stuff from like the artist's point of view, because they're obviously all Russian guys. A lot of them have moved on from the industry years and years and years ago. I did find a fan interview that was done through Discord from 2021, where the guy is just like getting increasingly like pissed off. Like, he starts out like answering the questions fairly well. He's like, oh yeah, this is what we did, this is how the studio worked. It's at the point where they start asking about like how the animation was made. They're like, oh, we heard the process was a bit fiddly. And he's like, yeah, it was simply horrible. Like, we had to draw on tracing paper, and then we scanned it on these cameras that were really blown out. And then we had to edit it pixel by pixel on this computer, and like Microsoft Paint didn't exist. So it was just like, I think they must have had to program in the pixels or something to that effect. Apparently, the studio also started out quite friendly, and then it got quite oppressive as time went on. Like, they weren't allowed to wear shorts in summer. Like, everyone's clocking in and out times were rigorously recorded. Interestingly, and I don't know if this is like something that got lost in translation, there was a Russian site I looked at that was talking about Animation Magic, and it was like, the headline was something to the effect of, oh, this gigantic studio you didn't even know was in Russia. And they mentioned, like, nobody was allowed to drink alcohol during the day. Is that standard? Again, Russian culture, don't know. I don't know if that, again, that's maybe a colloquialism that's got lost, but it was very funny for them to see no vodka was allowed to be consumed. Very strange. They also showed this animator, the Morshu RTX, like, 3D video at one point, and his only comment was, disgusting animation. So that's his sort of, it's very funny. I'm gonna link it in the description somewhere, because he just gets increasingly blunt as the interview goes on. It's like, just block the guy if you don't want to talk to him, like, geez. Yeah, Animation Magic sort of gets formed for this set of projects. And the first thing that they ship with Philips is Link, the Faces of Evil, and Zelda, the Wand of Gamelon. So these are two games that come out on the same day. They're side-scrolling adventure games, kind of in the same vein as Zelda 2. And then it has this sort of idea of being an animated adventure where you interact with people and they start talking to you in these very strangely animated cutscenes. I do want to throw over the floor to you a little bit, David. I was wondering what your first like encounter with CDI stuff was, because it obviously blew up quite a bit on the internet in like the mid 2000s, mm-hmm. but I feel like everyone sort of has a different experience.
It was in either O&M or Endgame, or it was like, no one, like every couple of months, they're like, you know, the worst ever moments in Nintendo history.
Yes, and I think I might know what issue you're on about.
And it was like the Zelda ZDI games, and it was like just the kind of screenshot of the king guy,
yeah,
like my boy. and then that was about it until I saw, like, you know. And then we've talked later on, like, the YouTube poop stuff.
Years later, which we will get onto. It's a big, like, driving...
No.
You cannot talk about the CDI games, I don't think, in the modern day without talking about the meme factor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first I heard about them was, I can't remember if I did just randomly see a YouTube poop or if it was the AVGN episode, because those would have been around about the same time, like 2008. I do remember some of O&M's quite colorful descriptions. I'm pretty sure Chris Scullion must have written most of them because he's become quite a like CDI enthusiast in recent years. It's quite fun. He did a series on this channel titled Hack where he was playing a bunch of CDI games, trying to like reappraise them and, you know, trying to take a more like optimistic view to them. But there's a lot that just like, oh God, this is so like oppressively dated that like it's like squeezing blood from a stone. They do lift quite a few things from sort of the Deke cartoons, like the whole thing of like Link having this weird crush on Zelda and being like, oh, Zelda, we have a kiss.
Excuse me, princess.
Yeah, I don't think he says it in the CGI games, but that was that was the big thing in the Deke cartoons for sure. Interesting thing I found out was that the combined budget for the games is about $1.2 million, which isn't a huge amount for a game of its time. I mean, even today, like, obviously you have to adjust for inflation if you're talking about in today's money, but I always think about, I think what changed my perspective of this sort of thing was when Mighty No. 9 got funded. And I forget what the amount was in the end. I remember it like massively exceeded its funding goal, and it was definitely in the millions. But I remember it funded in the millions, and people were like, this is gonna be the best game ever, it's a multi-million dollar game. And then it came out the way it came out, and it had become clear that like the scope was far too big for what they'd promised. And yeah, I think it humbled a lot of people when it came to what to expect from that kind of budget. So yeah, the combined budget for this game was about $1.2 million. It sounds like the main reason they were even able to get that much was because the lead at Animation Magic, Dale DeCharon, had said to Phillips, well, you'll get your money's worth because we can make two games for one at this. Like, we can spend a lot of the money developing the engine, and then, you know, we can make these two games out of it. It's pretty evident that Wand of Gamelon, the Zelda game, is a lot more... like, it has a lot more of the passion put into it. Like, Faces of Evil is very perfunctory. It's like, I mean, it's not even called The Legend of Zelda. It's just called Link, The Faces of Evil. And it's very cursed because it's Link in the Zelda font, but it's very strange. But that's a very standard, go to Korodai and find fight the Faces of Evil, and that's it. Whereas Wand of Gamelon has this whole subplot where there's like treachery going on. You've got Duke Onglud who's going around, and I can literally recite the whole fucking Wand of Gamelon intro. It's insane how it starts. It literally starts with the king going, Duke Onglud is under attack by the evil forces of Ganon. I'm going to Gamelon to aid him. It's like, you just dropped, like, you've dropped like three names in one sentence, and like the only one that's familiar is Ganon. It's like, who's Duke Onglud? Well, he's under attack, okay. Ganon, his evil forces, okay, sure, he's invading. Where's Gamelon? What are you on about? And it's just a gigantic, like, lore dump all the way through. I do find it interesting, of course, that this was a sort of strategy that got echoed years later when Flagship, the team at Capcom, were doing the Oracle games. We will definitely talk about that because that's got a very interesting history as well. It sort of started out as a remake of the original Zelda for Game Boy Color, then it became the Triforce trilogy, I guess, where it was going to be three games that were interconnected with each other, and then they were like, oh god, how the fuck do we figure this out? Oh, this isn't going to work. And then it became the two Oracle games. But that sort of reuse of the engine and stuff, it's quite clever, honestly, for the time. I can't think of many games that really utilize that kind of strategy. Obviously Pokemon popularized it like years later, but that's more so the same game but with very small mechanical differences. This is the same engine but two completely different games. So they do these games. They're decently received for the time. They get their infamy far later as more people discover them. A lot of people are quite enthusiastic about the full screen cutscenes and stuff. It's quite fun seeing the sort of real-time animation. I think part of what causes the revisionism and people to go back and call them so atrocious is what comes next, which is Hotel Mario in 1994. So Hotel Mario is best described as a bastardization of an arcade game. It's like, the idea is you're going between these floors of a hotel and you just have to go around and shut doors. And you might say, Sam, that doesn't sound very exciting. Like, what's the big kick? Well, the big kick is that the enemies are walking around and they're also opening the doors as you're walking around, closing them. So you just go between floor to floor on elevators, you shut the doors, and the enemies come by, open them again, you got to shut them again. Some of the doors are trick doors. There's a jump button, but because the hotels are so small, it's very easy to jump into the underside of enemies and die that way. I did find out that actually the game was originally designed without a jump button, and then one of the designers' like kids came in as a playtester, and she was like, "Why can't you jump?" And then they were like, "Good point," and they gave her a credit in like the special thanks. But it's actually like one of the worst decisions of that game because they needed to just completely redesign the boards. Like they should have redesigned the boards. They didn't. So you get this game that's just so bad. And the cutscenes are bizarre. There's two voice actors for the entire game. There's Mark Grau, who's this guy that plays with, again, what was accepted as sort of the American view of Mario, where he's... I think it was the official story from Nintendo of America as well, though, where they're like, he's this guy from Brooklyn, he's this plumber. So he plays him with this really gruff voice like this. we need Toadstools. And Luigi's up here like this. And Toadstool's voice is like ear piercing. Apparently they were going to go with a different actress, and then they just like got someone on a whim who like wound up later marrying one of the producers. It sounds very romantic, but it's not a good performance, I don't think, for the free line she says. I will say as well, as on a slight sidebar, one of the things that I always associate with these CDI games is in the early YouTube poops, people didn't know how to like download videos straight off YouTube or whatever. So everyone would go to this site called Quebec Gamers. This is the first time I ever heard of Quebec, the French nation, part of Canada, territory. I don't actually know how it's defined. I just went to it. I saw it was all in French and I was like, oh, this is weird. But they had these rips of all the cutscenes that people could download, but they have the most ear-piercing sound quality. Like someone has turned the distortion way up, and by the time you get to the Toadstool cutscene, she's like, that was so distorted that my mic didn't even pick it up, I don't think. Just wanted to save people. But yeah, Hotel Mario is a gigantic mess, and I think they pack it in from that point. Zelda's Adventure, which I mentioned earlier, comes out. That's a sort of this one where it's live action actors, it's top down, so it's a bit more like a quote unquote traditional Zelda game, but it's much worse. Every screen you walk between takes an absolute age to load. I don't think there's any music. I think it's just like howling winds. All the actors are like, it feels like they're falling asleep through the performances. Like at the very least, the Zelda and the Mario stuff is like so bewildering that it's like enchanting. Whereas the Zelda's Adventure stuff I saw just seemed to just go on so long and take itself so weirdly seriously, even though it's like made with a budget of like a box of matches and some hope. But yeah, that's the lowdown on that whole catastrophe. And as I sort of say, they had a Donkey Kong game potentially planned. I would love to see something come out about that. The extra bit that I added to the Mario segment is that literally the day before we recorded this, some news got out that someone found a Hotel Mario prototype at a thrift store, which has like a alternate version of the intro. It has like Bowser has some voice acting. And also Mario has a slightly different take at the end, which feels very uncanny after years of hearing, like, you need instructions, check out the enclosed instruction book. Where instead he's like, press button one if you want to learn how to get through the hotels. Otherwise, press button two. It's like, really, it's actually kind of scary seeing like new animation, because in the original, it like freeze frames him halfway through holding up the one for button one. So he like looks at the camera with this like mid blink. that which people just thought was like a weird smolder, but no, they just froze the animation. But now we have this official art of the Hotel Mario holding up both his fingers, which is beautiful to me. So I sort of briefed David on this beforehand, mm-hmm. but the final part of this where I figured it was best to put a bow on it, because I was originally going to do a whole history of animation magic and some of the other projects they did, but I realized the scope was way too much for one segment. So I'm putting that to the side. I'm going to keep doing some research in my own time because I found some fascinating stuff. But I just wanted to sort of have a general like YouTube poop containment zone, a little reminiscence. I know this puts you on the spot slightly, David. Do you have a favorite YouTube poop that uses some of the CDI material, like off the top of your head?
I don't, but I am very fond of just saying no. No.
No.
No.
I've got that on a few soundboards. I've got spaghetti. I've got dinner. I mean, it's... yes. We will definitely come back to some other YouTube poop sources as well, because around the same time as this, people were doing like the Super Mario World cartoon, the Mario Brothers Super Show. I think the first YouTube poop is of the Mario 3 show. He's hot on our tail. It's a very strange video. I think it's from before YouTube even, but it was like uploaded to YouTube and called a YouTube poop in like 2005. And that's, everyone sort of goes back to that as like the progenitor of the whole thing. And then there's obviously like Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog. I think it's just a lot of older millennials and maybe like younger Gen Xers like going into college and like thinking back on these weird video game cartoons they watched and being like, what the fuck was that? And then just like screwing around with it and making them say swears and stuff. My personal favorite YouTube poops with the CDI characters in is one that's so of its era, which is called Link gets a job so that he can afford to buy a PlayStation 3, which is exactly what it is. It says on the tin. It's like the Sergeant Peppers of like YouTube poop icons at the time. Everyone's there. The Mario head from Mario Teaches Typing is there. The guy from Death Note is there. He goes to the restaurant. He says, "I'll take a potato chip," and then the Squad-a-la guy comes out and goes, "There is no potato chip." It's great, and it's so concise. It's like a tight 2 minutes. It's like, it's fantastic. But yeah, the fun thing as an addendum as well is that a couple of YouTube poop guys actually got some work on our set. Walrus guy, who did that Link gets a job video, did a little bit of animation. There's like a drunk guy that goes like, "There's the princess," and he gets the idea of the animation like down amazingly. I think the thing that gets forgotten sometimes when people talk about these games having such bad animation is like, especially in the case of the Zelda ones, it's very fluid, but it's like overly so. It's like there's all these weird zooms. There's no idea of like secondary action. All the characters' limbs seem to be operating independently of themselves. There's no concept of a model sheet either. Like in any given shot, a character can look like anything. So with Arzette, I was just overjoyed to see that people got the assignment in that way. And there's also sort of the latter-day patron saint of YouTube poop, Jimmy Davis, who does those crazy like edits of The King, like doing all the dances, all the Fortnite dances. He did some like 3D rotoscoped scenes in Arzette that looked like beautiful. So like, I think beyond anything, I'm so happy that this crazy butterfly effect happened where, you know, Philips and Sony start developing the CD, then it goes off in this weird direction where they both try to work with Nintendo, then Philips have a series of decisions that creates Hotel Mario and the Zelda CDI games. People rediscover them decades later, make fun of them, and then it eventually gets to the point where it all culminates in the fans of these things coming together and making a game. It just, even like thinking about it, just like really touches me. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I don't know, it's like the spirit of play in the internet that I enjoy so much. And I'm very excited to see what that team gets up to next. Happy memories, honestly. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's you.
Hello, hello.
What are you doing here?
I got here as fast as I could.
Oh, that's crazy. The boys at the precinct didn't tell me you were coming.
I got here as fast as I could.
No, no, stay. I've got to talk to you anyway. Come on in. Interrogation 2 is free. We're not expecting any crimes today. Oh, sorry. Got a thing in my throat. I want to talk to you about something.
Go on.
Close the door. Close the door. Cool. Thanks. Let's talk about a 6-month period. Not even that, just 2 months. May, November, 2011.
Mm-hmm.
2011 is an interesting year because, and we've talked about this before, it's like the beginning of the end of like Nintendo's kind of handheld slash console divide, because obviously after, that's when the 3DS launches, and after that then it's the Wii U, when it's like, you know, bring kind of closer together, and the Switch is like, you know, it's both. Lady Gaga brought up Born This Way. We never really talk about how the album artwork for that album is her turning to a motorcycle. It's very disconcerting.
You're right, we don't.
Yeah, and look, movie-going audiences were going to see stuff like Paul, and I guess other movies, but, you know, mainly Paul 2011.
What was the main event?
Mm-hmm.
I call it the unofficial fourth film in the Cornetto trilogy.
It should be the best movie ever, and it is. But I want to touch on one of those things, both briefly and more generally, if you'll allow me the paradox of, you know, brief and general.
Mm-hmm.
The latter stages of the early days of the 3DS are kind of weird, because it's like every other console, really. It's full of these games that like either don't really know what to do with the gimmick of the 3DS, or the many gimmicks in the 3DS case, or they like really lean into it and it becomes like kind of overwhelming, but like how much stuff they're doing. There's one game that released on November 1st that kind of is in the midpoint of both of those things, but I don't want to talk about it yet because we have to go back to the beginning.
Mm.
And the beginning is December 11th, 2002.
Knew it. Go on.
Team Soho's latest game, The Getaway, is released. Have you ever played The Getaway?
I have not, but I have heard people hype it up for years.
Mm-hmm. I haven't played it either, but I did watch bits of it on YouTube.
I've heard some very strange people describe it as Britain's GTA, which is silly because the GTA games are developed in Dundee. What the fuck? Anyway, maybe that's an optimistic view of the independence of Scotland. I don't know. Anyway.
It's a third person, the guy was like a third person kind of quasi action adventure crime open worldy kind of title. And it kind of boasts like a large scale recreation of like not all of London, I think, but like bits of London where you can like drive for, like you're driving around like you're a criminal, whatever. But we're not interested in the getaway. We're interested in who got away, because the director and co-writer of the getaway is Brendan McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
And he leaves Team Soho soon after this. I think it's like 2003 he leaves. And he goes back to Australia, which is where he's from, with, I think, a few people from Team Soho, and they form Team Bondi. And they begin to work on their big, big project. A game that, like The Getaway, will reproduce large swathes of a famous, storied city. Several years later, and via a publishing deal with Rockstar, L.A. Noire arrives to fanfare, big promises, and hype.
Matchboxes were rotated everywhere.
Mm-hmm. But it also leaves in its wake what I can only describe as alleged human rights violations. You can read about it on IGN Australia, like a huge expose on, like, you know, how basically inhumane the working conditions of Team Bondi were when they were making this game. Like, people were like pissing into bottles or whatever. Like, it was extreme crunch, like you couldn't go home. But while this was happening, that was like May 2011, L.A. Noire hits the shelves. In Canada, Ubisoft Montreal, in conjunction with, you guessed it, Ubisoft, are preparing to release a detective mystery of their own. James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D. And in itself, it is quite similar to L.A. Noire, and that's why I called you down here today. See, I lied. I did call you down here. You thought they were down here by choice, but I actually engineered a situation where you would come down here. So we're going to look at these games, but we're going to look at the narrative, because we look at the real world narrative, we're going to look at the in-game narrative. Mm. And first we're going to look at the characters. In L.A. Noir, you play as the man with the whitest name possible, Cole Phelps. But in and you knew this, because in James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D, you have to name yourself. So you, Sam, are the protagonist of James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D. As such, I'm treating you as a suspect in my investigation.
Yeah.
That's right. This is a sting operation. That door's locked. You can sit down. Don't get up.
My God.
The boys of the precinct have brought some of my attention. We think you, with L.A. Noir, were planning something in 2011. See, this is the thing. We think, because you're both noir pastiches, and that's not a pastry, trust me, I found the hard way, we think you were trying to plan something. And so we're going to sit here and we're going to figure out whether or not the coincidences between L.A. Noir and James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D, which you were part of, are intentional. And there was some grand plan that, you know, didn't come off right. Maybe didn't work out. Maybe you're going to try to take over the industry, but you failed. We're going to figure this one out. We're going to see whether or not that's what happened. I'm not a cop, by the way. I'm like Poirot. If Poirot wasn't friends with police officers, which he is, which is unfortunate, you know. So settle down, we'll begin. Let's start off with the characters again, okay? Because, like, we could talk all day about how L.A. Noir has, like, extreme mocap.
I would very gladly talk all day about how it has extreme mocap.
It's the same thing with like the CDI and with, like, you know, everyone knows, but, like, you know, Hotel Mario. We could talk about how, like, you know, the game had the power given to put in half of the supporting cast of Mad Men and the weird guy from Mulholland Drive.
God, what are we good to see some of the reference footage for Zelda. Sorry, I am just thinking about, like, some of the scenes where it's, like, clearly rotoscoped, and I'm just like, oh, what I'd give.
Maybe they did the same thing here, which is that they put John Noble from Fringe into the game and gave him the most vocal fry imaginable, because every single one of his lines is like vocal fry dish.
I hear they put a lot of the Mad Men from Mad Men in boxes.
They did.
Which I hear is where you put Mad Men.
It is. But look.
I'm the mad cop now.
This is the thing, though. We can talk about that until the cows come home.
Mm.
And it is quite kind of cloying and embarrassing when, like, you know, you're trying to solve a crime and you're talking to, like, you know, Greg Grunberg from Heroes, and he says something and then he immediately goes like, ooh, and
you're
like, sucks his lips. And you're like, he's clearly lying to me, or whatever. You know, like,
if they had the tech, they'd have had the little Dr. Evil pinky come up.
But the thing is, like, as cloying as that is, it is very immersive at the same time.
Mm.
And I think had it just been, like, you know, standard, like 3D animation, it would have been kind of boring. But you play as Cole Phelps for most of L.A. Noir. I don't know. I know that you've played L.A. Noir, but I don't know necessarily if you know the late game.
Yes, I got quite far, and then I got quite tired with the final cases, so I kind of just looked up how it ends.
So at a certain point, switch characters from Cole Phelps to Jack Kelso, who is a former squad member of Cole's in the army, and he's also like an insurance like, you know, like insurance companies have like detectives that, like, they send out to, like, check your claims to make sure, like, you're not doing anything weird. He's like one of them, and the only difference between, like, him and Cole is that Cole has like a squad car, but Jack has like a normal car. And instead of it's like starting at missions in the police station, you start in, like, your third story office, and you take, like, an elevator down to, like, the ground floor whenever you, like, want to, like, go and do, like, a mission, which is quite, I don't know. But look, you know all that, just like you know that, like, James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D doesn't have an interrogation system. And you could, again, talk about the mechanics of that interrogation system, wherein, like, you have, like, you know, the lie, the truth, the doubt, the good cop, backup, accuse options, but that they've been mean to shit at this point, okay? But what hasn't happened is that you haven't accepted that you were the lead character of James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D. I'm giving you a chance now, because, and you tell me the truth, Okay, you have three options here. What is your job slash role in the overall narrative of this game? And here are your three options. You got to pick one. Option one, a retired cop forced into solving a new series of murders in Hollywood alongside a rookie when at some point you were implicated in the crimes. Okay, that's your first option. Mm. Option two, you're a suspect in the murder. You must clear your name when all evidence points to you. Okay, option three, you're a contestant on a TV game show with personal connections to an ongoing series of murders. Which one are you?
Oh, I do actually know this one. I will say, sorry, midway, you took quite a Rod Serling turn. You were like, you're a murderer. Imagine if how fucked up it would be if you were a murderer and you were solving your own crimes. Attached as a zip file. God, yeah, it's scary door. Yes, well, it was so long ago, but I do believe I was in a game show.
See, I knew you knew who you were. That's right, you're a contestant on The Incredible Puzzle Master Show, which they say every single time.
Like, it is not what it's called.
It is. It's like your favorite TV show, The Incredible Puzzle Master Show. It's set in like 1961, and even then it feels like an anachronism.
Mm.
Each fortnight, Bruce Fortnight, you have to solve enough puzzles to beat or match a specific score set by your rival, Marcus White.
Oh, piss off, Ubisoft.
Basically, he performs a week before you do. And whoever wins the competition wins an all-expenses-paid trip around the world.
They just called him Marcus White? Like, not Marcus Ivory? Or, literally any Senate? Sorry, go on.
It's kind of interesting that, like, LA Noir's kind of endgame has, like, a trip around the world competition as well. There's a whole host of characters in this one that you know about, such as over-eager game show host Glenn Darnby, who keeps wanting to, like, talk to you about stuff.
Uh-huh.
The eternally grumpy producer Trudy Mills, who keeps trying to sell the show abroad, and she wants for you to sign off and selling your episodes abroad.
Mm.
And a former associate of yours who you fell out with him years ago, FBI agent Lieutenant Matt Booker.
The names are getting Ace Attorney in a way that's not endearing.
They all orbit around you, and you know that already. But I thought it was really interesting that you never really found them suspicious, did you? You let them all in. But where are my manners? I forgot to ask you something. See, I mentioned earlier on that LA Noir has this groundbreaking tech. But I neglected to kind of touch on what James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D does. So let's get this straight. James Noir is presented as one of the following. Is it? Number one, full motion video or FMV with voice acting. Option two, still image cutscenes with voice acting.
Oh, man.
Option three, awkward 3D animated cutscenes with voice acting.
Oh, you... All of these are after my heart. Oh, I really... Please tell me it's FMV. Please.
Is that your answer?
It is my final answer. Please.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Now, finally, you might see why I'm making this argument.
Yeah.
Two games, both, as I said, noir pastiches, but released in the same year, just months apart. And then one takes a forward-looking approach of big mocap, big cinematic gameplay and stuff.
Mm.
And the other is a real throwback to PC games with FMV gameplay and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting, the cutscenes in James Noir. The actors aren't saying anything. They're moving their mouths up and down, and then they're doing all the action. So it's clear that they recorded all the cutscenes, and then we're okay, script time, get a script ready. We have all the footage already.
Just they do it in the movies, baby.
So it's a really clear looped animation of Adam Jensen from Deus Ex Human Revolution, opening his mouth and closing his mouth and being like, I'm Lieutenant Matt Booker. How are you doing today? And it's
that's inspired. I really, this is some insane deep lore, but when I was doing my sketch channel on YouTube, Shortcut Arcade, I really wanted to do some kind of FMV riff, and that was the exact thing I wanted to do. Just record a bunch of footage of us like bobbing our mouths at, like, with different shot, reverse shot, and then just create an absolutely like incoherent sketch out of it. I think I wanted to recreate like a Mortal Kombat fight or something. I like bought a big sheet of green felt and was like, we'll record in front, we'll take pictures in front of a green screen and then just make a fucking Mortal Kombat fight. Again, when you're a teenager and you have too much time on your hands, you come up with some deranged ideas.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was making a video game magazine. And
you're not qualified for that. Get out of here.
Not qualified. Mm-hmm. And also interviewing people like Chris Antista and getting embarrassed by doing that because I asked him, it was when the 3DS came out, and I there was a when the 3DS came out, like all these tabloids were doing stories like, you know,
it'll burn Mother your eyes
returns
out.
3DS, yeah. And I was like, I asked him like a question, like, did you hear like about, like, because I was one of those like teens who was like really
Scully,
like,
you hear about the 3DS alien?
It was like one of those kids like really like incensed by people talking nonsense about things I liked, you know, and like you're like a really like when like that becomes your personality, and it's like,
as all gamers should be,
yeah,
at all times on the defensive,
because it's like an attack at my personality, at my very self, if you don't like the thing I like.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I asked him like, did you hear about this mom who like returned a 3DS because she thought it was going to like destroy her child's brain, being like, oh, I'm like a really good soundbite from like Chris Antista here. It's really, really great. And then he like, because it was like an email, like I sent all the questions to, and his response was like, is this meant to be a joke? And it like destroyed my my entire like ego. And I never tried doing that again afterwards. I was like, I'm never doing this again. I'm abandoning this for the rest of my life.
Oh, that's rough.
I'm actually going to head out, so I'm going to do a quick break kind of thing here. Listen, sure. We're not done with questioning right now, okay? Don't think we're done with questioning here, because we're not. But I got like a cup of Joe, and I'll be right back. Okay, the boys out there were saying, I'm going to make a big meal out of meat potatoes here. It's a meat potatoes case, but I said, I've already eaten dinner, I don't want to eat again. Sorry, I'm trying to buff up, I get my notes up again. Okay, but what I want to focus on here now is how both games deal with the kind of, what I would call the macabre. And I hate that word because I had an English teacher who can never pronounce it. Or couldn't pronounce it like a normal way, so she go like macabre. It was always be really embarrassing.
That's great.
But to understand where I'm coming from, I mean, you already know this as well because you played the game. But like, LA Noir is divided into like five different sections. There's like the patrol section, which is like the tutorial where you go through each kind of stage of a crime. Each stage of a crime. There's traffic where all you're doing is like driving to someone's house, being like, you killed someone with your car. And the guy's like, I didn't do it. I was leaving my wife, but I didn't do it. And then, you know, obviously you chase them, you punch them and you arrest them. There's Vice where like it's really where like the main plot of the game kicks in like 60% of the way through the game. But that's what happens here. That's where, like, you know, Mickey Cohen and all Cole's old friends are like pushing heroin, and then Cole has an affair, and they leak that press to the press, and then he gets kicked out and gets put onto the arson desk, where it's just about finding out fires and all that kind of stuff. But I want to focus on the second desk, which is homicide, which I think is like so unique within the game because it's its own contained narrative. But before we begin, I have to say, like, you know, kind of content warning here, because like I won't talk about it in depth, but like part of this requires me to talk about like really kind of like graphic stuff to do with, like, you know, blood and dismemberment. So, you know, if that affects you, you know, you can skip ahead a bit. I won't mind. But I'd ask you a question, which is, do you know about the Black Dahlia?
I don't.
I'll try and keep it brief because it is really brutal and heartbreaking. Jeez.
Okay.
It unfortunately, like most true crime stuff, like Elizabeth Short, who was the victim of the Black Dahlia case, is kind of known for how she died. Mm. And that's like a problem I have with true crime stuff, is that, like, you know, it turns the victim to, like, you know, spectacle and, like,
yeah,
entertainment and stuff. Basically what happened is, like, she was found, like, surgically, like, mutilated, and her body was, like, completely contorted and bisected and stuff. It was really horrible. There's, like, really, like, a lot of heart, like, my research for this part was, like, looking at the Wikipedia page, because I was, like, you know, I can't really stomach a lot of this kind of stuff. And what I found was that, like, because William Randolph Hearst was, like, you know, the big newspaper guy. He was, like, you know, famously really, really horrible person. Like, the whole Hearst empire was, like, really, like, you know, built on really, like, horrible stuff. One of his papers, like, found her mom and, like, called her up on the phone and was like, "Your daughter has won a beauty contest. Can you tell us, like, all this information about her so we can, like, you know, print a profile about how, you know, she's won this beauty contest?" And so her mom's like, "Oh yeah, her name's Elizabeth." She's like, "You know, this.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they were like, "Oh, by the way, she actually got murdered. But thank you for telling us all this information. Do you want us to fly you out to Los Angeles, and, you know, so you can be at her funeral or whatever?" And people were like, that was actually because if they wanted to fly her out to Los Angeles, because if they let the mom, like, out of their sight, another paper could, like, find her. So they were like, instead of they wrapped this act of kindness up and, like, you know, we can protect our source and be the first people to report, like, all this information that we shouldn't have. But anyway, they kind of know who did the Black Dahlia. There's a surgeon that they, it's pretty much like, you know, it was this guy, but we can never pin it on him. The problem is, as you know, what L.A. Noire presupposes is, what if it wasn't this guy? What if it was this guy? And the problem with that is, so a series of murders in L.A. Noire, say the homicide desk, were like, all these bodies are showing up, the copycat killers of the Black Dahlia. There's, like, that ridiculous one, don't remember, where, like, the guy, like, paints a trail of blood from, like, the body up, like, over rooftops, up, like, drain poles, to, like, a rooftop, like, ages away, where, like, that's, like, the most, like, video game logic of this, and obviously it gets worse later on. But obviously then, like, you know, you go through each case, and it becomes obvious that, like, you're arresting people in each case because you need to arrest someone, but, like, it's clear it's, like, a serial killer. And then, like, the last case of homicide, it turns out, like, okay, the Black Dahlia killer is still out there, and we gotta go find him. And this is a bit of the game that's closest to James Noir, Hollywood Crime Story.
Sorry, the way you said that just made me think of, "And you gotta help us!
You gotta help us! Too many toasters!" this is the point where it's, like, most similar to James Noir, because, you know, in L.A. Noir, you get, like, a riddle on, like, a piece of paper at, like, each location. So basically what you do is you have to go to different locations on the map that, like, are corresponding to, like, a riddle that you're given.
Yeah.
And then you do, like, this whole, like, song dance of, like, you know, there's that one where you have to climb onto a chandelier and do, like, tightrope walk over a chain to the chandelier, and then you get, like, the first clue and the bit of, like, evidence and stuff.
Yeah.
In James Noir, you have to, like, solve puzzles to, like, progress the plot. And the plot is, like, you know, you do the game show, and then in between the game show, Matt Booker will be like, "Listen, can you take this cube and do a maze on the cube, and then unlock the cube, please? Because we can't do it."
Yeah.
And then it's just like, you just turn the cube around, like, "Oh, the path is here." It's like the 2-second job, not you're a bit of a fucking idiot. There's another one where, like, you basically, the plot of the game is that, like, former champions on your game show are dying, but they're being murdered. And Matt Booker comes to you and is like, "Listen, buddy, I think if you play as, like, because it's one of those games where it's like you can play as a man or a woman. If you play as a woman, he's, like, your ex-boyfriend or something.
Interesting.
But if you play as a man, it's like he's just, like, an associate. But either way, he's with the FBI. He's like, "We need your help because these people are dying, and we think you're going to be a target if you win this game, so can you help us like solve these puzzles to like see where we're going to go to like find more evidence. And at one point you go to like a theater and you have to like solve this puzzle to like light up the stage, and you find like a dead body and you have to like solve a tile puzzle, like a sliding tile puzzle, which are always like, the worst fucking puzzles in these games.
That's what killed the guy, probably.
Yeah,
he bashed his head in against the wall, like, God, no, please.
But like when you solve the tile puzzle, it like reveals it's like your ID photo, which, by the way, you have to like take a photo on the 3DS.
Of course you do. Of course you do. It's Ubisoft.
Yeah. But this is like, this is one of the, it's where I say, like, you know, some games overindulge in all the gimmicks.
Yeah.
You take a photo of yourself.
Uh-huh.
And there's like a really funny thing.
I'm so
there's
excited.
A really funny thing between like sometimes between rounds, it'll like cut to like your dressing room.
Uh-huh.
And they'll put a frame of like a dressing room mirror on the top screen and activate the camera.
Yes.
So it looks like you're like doing like your makeup for the
God. That's so good. They're so powerful.
But eventually, it's just like,
I'm sorry, small sidebar again. We are definitely gonna have some kind of episode where we talk about how, like, even though Ubisoft are insane and kind of an evil company, like, the insanity is like, oh, it's so good. They make such just bonkers decisions.
But anyway, like, at that point in, like, at some point in both games, you go to a murder house. So in LA Noire, it's obviously like you go to that church at the end of the homicide desk, and the killer is waiting for you there. And sidebar, one of the stupidest parts of this game, beyond the bit where like you, because you go to like all these different locations, and one location is the intolerance set, which is like you go to in the traffic desk as well to like do a big shootout.
Yes.
But I don't know if you remember the bit where like you have to like balance on like a piece of the set that's falling down, but you'd like crab walk around it so you, so it doesn't knock over. It's almost a gamified bit, but like at the end of like the homicide desk, you find the murderer, and like Cole is like, oh my god, it's you, the bartender from this bar. But like the only way you find out like that he's like a bartender is if in like a specific traffic desk case, you go back to like a location after you've done like the stuff there and go inside and talk to him, which is a really annoying kind of thing. But in James Noir, there's a bit where like you have to drive to this house, and Mash Booker stops to get petrol, which is like, you know, a classic Matt Booker move, you know, I gotta stop to get some petrol. He stops for petrol, and you for whatever reason you pick the lock on his glove compartment. And this is another problem I have with like both games, but more so James Noir. It has another kind of trope I don't like, which is like you find a folder in there that says like you've got like schizophrenia and that you're potentially murderous because you have schizophrenia and you're a freak. You're crazy. And then there's like a note saying like has to have constant like surveillance in case, you know, he kills. So you kind of realize that the game's being like, you know, maybe you're actually killing everyone you don't remember, which is reflected by the fact that like the house you're driving to.
Yeah.
When you get out of the car, Matt's like, buddy, this is your old house. How do you not remember living here? And you go inside and there's this really weird puzzle where like there's like four clocks and you've like pull like the cords on it's like those clocks have the big, you know, like industrial cords.
Yeah.
The famous cord. The famous clocks.
You ever heard of the clock cord, Scully?
And you pull them in an order, and it opens like a trap door, and you go down, and it's like Jigsaw's basement because there's like a lot of like evil Jack in the Box kind of things. And you solve all these puzzles, and the last puzzle is like this giant metallic skull that you've like put together by like rotating like different planes of the skull, and you unlock this like cabinet where like all these old trophies from it's like a shrine to like all the old champions with all their trophies. And then Matt Booker's like, put your hands up, you're under arrest. And it turns out that was a sting operation as well, that like you actually were the killer. The way I said that, I was like, no, you actually were the killer as well. What happens then, though?
We'll blow your mind.
We'll blow your mind, because the next bit of James Moore is that you wake up in jail. And this is so stupid.
Uh-huh.
There's like a puzzle earlier on that also takes control, because again, Ubisoft.
Yeah.
There's a puzzle where using like the gyro controls, you have to like.
Yes, move. I was wondering when the gyro was going to come up. I wanted to pester you. I wanted to be halfway through the segment. I wanted to be. I'm bored. Where's the gyroscope? I need to. Mother, I want to use the microphone.
Mother, the gyroscope. You have to like move like it's one of the puzzles in like the game show. To like move a green box through like this kind of not like a maze but like you know like it's like a map where like there's like you know partitions that if you hit like the partition it will slide. It's like a slide puzzle basically. Just slide like a box from like one.
Oh, number one.
What it's not as like a tile puzzle, but, like, you slide like a box from one end of the touch screen to another from like
right.
Only in this one, it like fades up. And like the grid that you're sliding through is like all rusted metal. There's all the smoke, and there's a giant eyeball on the top screen, with the camera turned on, so you can see your reflection in the eyeball.
And oh, that's actually kind of cool.
It's meant to be like you're crazy. You're crazy, and there's like no point to the puzzle because it doesn't like unlock anything. It's like here's a puzzle where you slide stuff, but you're crazy. And when you come out of that puzzle. The warden's like, I got a letter for you. Gotta read it. And you go over and you open the letter, and it's like, guess what? I'm the real killer. I framed you. But here's how you break out of your cell. And you do like a puzzle involving all the bricks in your cell. Like you, there's like a corner where like it's like the builders didn't build your cell properly. They cut corners, literally. So you. Much like a TV show on UK TV reality or Dave.
What do you mean they cut corners literally? They cut corners in the bricks?
Yeah, you basically there's like a corner of your cell made of bricks where like they didn't do the bricks properly. So you like
you figure out a
pattern and you pick the bricks in a certain pattern and the whole brick wall comes down and you escape into the wall of the cell. You do a couple more puzzles and you escape out of the prison. You go back to Los Angeles, and you already know this because you were in the game. You go back to Los Angeles on a train. Mm. You go to the TV station. You call the police via you do a puzzle to reactivate the phone, which is like it's like a drop down puzzle where like you have to it's a tipping point only it's with like with quarters.
This is insane.
You activate the phone, you ring the police, and then you go and confront like the real killer who like knocks you out.
Mm.
And they knock you out and they're like, we're going to play like a round of this game. Only if you get the questions right or you get the puzzles right, I get shocked by like electric shocks. And then you obviously win the game and the police come and arrest the real killer. So I want to see if you remember who did it. Because, you know, this will prove the boys right.
Uh-huh.
So was it number one, Marcus White, your rival on the show? Perhaps he wanted you out of the picture to win, but then he couldn't take not having the chance to beat you fair and square, and he went insane.
Yeah.
Was it number two, Trudy Mills? She was keen to have you and all the other contestants sell your rights. Maybe the original champion said no, and she killed him and framed you.
Uh-huh.
Was it number three, Glenn Darnby? Jealous of other people getting the spotlight for his show, he went on a killing spree, and then panicking, he got you put in jail. Or was it four, Matt Booker? Perhaps he was playing the long con and wanted to confront you on your own terms to get you sent away. Who was it?
Oh, man. I have no clue. Oh god, I swing for the fences. I'm gonna go for Mr. Red Herring himself, Marcus White. I just have to know.
That was incorrect.
No, I got tricked by your clever narrative, Ubisoft.
I wonder who else got tricked by Ubisoft's clever narrative. Was it the three characters who appear in the background, or was it the character who helps you the entire time and wants your help? And perhaps needs your help, and perhaps led you to the murder house, and perhaps got you arrested, and then perhaps put you in jail. Was it perhaps Matt Booker? Yes, it was. Only it turns out Matt Booker, the file you read in the car was Matt's, not yours. Matt Booker is crazy, and he wants to take you down. It is so convoluted, that's so silly. The actor goes absolutely crazy.
Because it's FMV. I keep forgetting this. It's FMV.
It's FMV. It's like the proper like FMV.
How's the 3D, by the way?
Oh, well, I play on the I play on the 2DS.
Maybe I'll have to step into James Noir's Twisted World myself, and because live action video only ever has like one setting, and it would probably be way too strong because it's a launch year game, and it will blind me.
Speaking of James Noir, James Noir is in for like 2 seconds. By that I mean the game opens and it's a guy like at a typewriter being like, Hollywood, full of mysteries. Here's a story about a mystery in Hollywood. And it cuts to like this opening cutscene of like, you're on TV, what's your name? Where are you from? What's your photo? I'm Glenn Darnby. Anyway, the post game of these two games are very similar as well. And there's nothing to do.
Yeah, I forgot. And like, technically, the post game. There's probably going to be no other place to talk about it. But like, LA Noire is such a wasteful game in terms of like, they built this gigantic open world and there's nothing in it. There's doors with golden handles that you can go inside. There's film canister you can find. There's the worst, most unfun driving. Like, the scope drives me like bonkers. It's so pointless.
It's so crazy. There's a whole thing of like, you do free roam and you can like solve street crimes, which are like, you know, miniature action scenes. The problem with that is that
they suck.
I learned this the hard way. And it's the hard way. They suck, but also they don't turn off when you solve them. So what happens to me?
You just do them over and over.
Yeah, I solved one. Which is like, this guy's like robbing a shop and like you see him and he sees you and you chase him up like some scaffolding and you knock him out. I did that one and I was like, perfect, that's done. I drove off. I'm driving around. I get a thing on my radio and like, calling all units. It's a 502 in progress. All units respond. I say, okay, I'll do that one, you know. Drive back. It's the exact same one. I do it again. I'm like, okay.
Why, Ayada? You perps.
You again. So I do that again. I drive off, right? I'm driving. The dispatcher says there's a whatever in progress. I say, okay, I'll do that one. Same one again.
Oh my God.
At this point, I'm like, I'm not going to get fooled again. You know, I'm like George Bush, you know. Fool me, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, won't get fooled again. And I respond to another one. It's a different one this time. I'm like, thank God. Okay, different street crime. That's fine. Driving around again, get the buzz. Okay, I'll go do it. Drive there. It's the same one again. So I did it 4 times in one second. And I was like, I'm not doing this again. So it's really annoying. It doesn't switch off. They turn off all like the banter between you and your partner as well. So it's like you just run around in silence.
Yeah,
it's so like dead and so soulless and so just. It's so infuriatingly stupid. Like just to be like, and like it's a game that like. And I said this before, it's like a game that's like drowning in its ambition.
Yeah.
At the point where like it just doesn't really like capitalize on any of it. Like
it's a game.
It's a game of ideas.
Yes, exactly. It's a game where they did stuff, but they didn't actually have a plan for how they were gonna use it. They were like, we're gonna do this face capture. And like there was a kind of idea there where they were like, oh, it's gonna show the nuances of the characters. And then when they get the people in the booth, they get them to do these ridiculous contorted faces. And then it's like, we're gonna build this recreation of LA. Okay, what are you gonna put in it? There will be 5 buildings you can go into.
It's like it's just so silly. Like, I guess like they spend too much time just violating human rights to think about doing it properly, you know.
I think it's also where they got up in their own head about how long they'd been developing on it, and you know, it has a similar issue from what I've heard to Duke Nukem Forever as well, where the insane guy, I forget what his name is, McNamara or whatever, that would come in, would see a new game with some new feature, and then would come in and be like, we're putting that in the game, ship it, like, get it in there, and then it would just suck.
It's
so bad. I can't even pray, because the thing is, I usually can be quite appreciative of something like shoots for the stars and misses, you know.
Yeah,
like I'm a big fan of Stop Skeletons from Fighting, who's this YouTube channel that does what do they call it? They do a specific series. The slogan of it is like, we celebrate the weird, the ambitious, or the unnecessary. And it's usually about stuff like the weird, like 3D conversion of like Driver 3 on like Game Boy Advance, or like the GTA games on Game Boy Color, or all the different versions of like Resident Evil on like mobile phones and stuff like that. I can get behind when a developer has grand ideas. The problem is when they have those grand ideas and there's no direction. And yeah, I mean, you know, there's been countless postmortems about L.A. Noire. I don't think any amount of suffering that they put the artists through would have been worth it, like, no matter how good the game would have been. But it doesn't help that it's a bad game as well. I feel like people cut it way too much slack for way too long, and it doesn't deserve it, frankly.
One of the most infuriating things is, and this is just being like, you know, Here's whatever moment. There was, because obviously the complete version that came out recently puts all like the DLC into it as like actual missions that you have to do. There's one in like the Vice section where you have to like, it opens with like you and your partner going to this person's house, and they have like, I think it's either AK-47s or like Tommy guns, but like they have like proper guns. And you have to hide behind like this like really low like stone wall and like take them out while they're firing at you. And every single time I try to do it, immediately I was mowed down. Like there was no like option of being like, you know, okay, I can take cover here and shoot them. I get up, I aim, and immediately gone. To the point where like after three attempts the game was like, look, buddy.
Yeah.
Just skip this. Just skip it. Just here you go.
Just sweep it under the rug.
Just move on. That might be the same level that ends with you like storming like a soup factory, and like going like, because so much of this game,
the shootouts are so bad in that game.
They're really bad. The final level, the final fucking mission is a shootout in a dimly lit sewer where you can't see where there's like barely any cover. You can't see where anyone's coming from. And at one point, you just like, you have to like walk across water while like all these like, enemies just wait for you to like get up on this platform to take you out. It's so fucking stupid. But like, we gotta look where these games went, because your scheme didn't work.
They went down the toilet.
They went down the drain, like everyone's hopes. So James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D. You don't call a game James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D intending for it to be a single release about a game show murder. That's clearly like, you know, saying enough for like, you know, here's our new series, James Noir.
It's from they're going to do 4D.
The twisted
it's going to spray water at you.
It's going to make you solve cubes, but real. Obviously, there were no other James Noir games. There was though, in 2016, a remake that was released for iPhone.
What?
I haven't played it. I haven't looked at it at all. I can't imagine it's FMV. It has to be some other thing, because I can't imagine them putting like a game that's like intended for like two screens on a phone and having it still be like FMV stuff. Now, Team Bondi famously put this game out and then like more or less immediately perish.
There was another project, David.
There was another project. I'm not going to say the name of it because it is doubly offensive. It's like
take blank one of the blank.
Blank of the blank. the footage leaked of it recently, and I was like, oh, I want to see what it looks like. And it's just some fucker running around. It's just some guy running. I was like, okay. But like, They were going to make a sequel. Obviously, I think a mix of the inherent cost of having to do something like that again, and the whole thing about how they ruined so many people's lives trying to make this game. Even like George Miller, you know, bought, I don't know if the, his company bought Team Bondi or like they bought like, you know, into the idea of Team Bondi, but like Team Bondi just dissolved.
Yeah,
I'd love to say that Brendan McNamara was, you know, driven away or cast out or whatever, but things don't work that way. Much like how in 2003, wherever it was, they started working on L.A. Noir, Brendan pivoted it once again, away from extreme mocap into virtual reality. I don't know if you remember the L.A. Noir VR case files.
Yeah.
I was shocked to learn that that was him. That like, he is like the guy behind that. I don't know how, but as of 2020, he is allegedly working on an original VR IP for Rockstar. And all I can say is I will not be there. I also have no idea what an original AAA VR experience is, but this sounds like something that is going to be completely... By the time that comes out, VR will probably be like either, you know, priced out of most people's price range or just like not worth it. But look, you're free to go now. But remember this. In 2011, two games came out. Both of them pushing themselves as, you know, the past and future of mystery games. Both of them. And I would argue that they both kind of took center stage because LA Noire, like, you know, it was like, you know, here's the one of the first big proper next-gen titles, you know, this big open-world detective game. Rockstar's publishing it. You have all these like crazy like film actors like John Noble with his Barney the Dinosaur head. He's in here. James Noir's Hollywood Crimes 3D was a 3DS exclusive, so it is taking center stage on that system. Honestly, as I said, it's doing all the things with like the camera and the gyro and touchscreen and somehow not the microphone. I was going to hope it'd be like a microphone element, but there isn't. But they both failed. But I wouldn't say they're really... I think LA Noire, for all its faults, is still kind of inherently like replayable. It's a stupid, silly experience, but like you do, there is like some element of that is kind of not so much addictive, but like it keeps you coming back just to see like what's going to happen. James Noir is one of those games where like it's very easy to be like, okay, I want to play like a puzzle game that like isn't too taxing for, you know, 2 hours. It's going to have fun FMV cutscenes. It's going to, you know, be a laugh. So they're not inherent failures. Like, you know.
Much like noir protagonists, they falter they in down. Their final acts. They fall apart.
I could see our legs going from Miles and they were going away from me.
this gam didn't have legs at all. She was barely walking.
She was a box I had to open to find. Oh, I never told you the end of James Noir. The end of James Noir is so crazy. The most embarrassing thing I've ever experienced in the game. I don't mean like the game embarrassing. I mean like I felt embarrassed that this happened to me. So you put Matt Booker in jail. You may think, like, what do you think? And this isn't a question that I have prepared. Like, if you had to think to yourself, okay, I've just sent this guy who's a killer to jail. How is this game? Like, what's the end of the game here? Is this where the game
sequel
ends?
Sequel hook. Sequel hook.
Sequel hook. There is kind of a sequel hook, but the way it ends is that it like loads you into your dressing room, and Marcus White appears by the door, and he says, "Good luck, buddy." And you're like, "Oh, you're gonna let me play again?" He says, "I'm going on my trip now, but good luck." It turns out that for some reason, the TV show wants you to play the round you didn't play, but you won't win anything for playing it. It's just like, you know, we're sorry. We need you to play. We need you to play the game that in the episode that you weren't in, just for the sake of completion. You won't win the prize, but you know, here you go. So what? they force you to finish out your contract. You play the game. You go back to your dressing room. There's one final puzzle there for you to solve, which is again another one of those cubes where like you have to like, you know, map out a maze on the cube. The cube opens. You know what's in there? One of the stones from your prison cell. Matt Booker was put into your prison cell. He escaped and he's come to get you. And then hard cut the credits. Game ends. And the post game for that game is that you just replay puzzles you didn't play before. That's literally it.
I was gonna say the most embarrassing way that the game could end would be if like one of the cops turned around and it was like Eves, like the president of Ubisoft. He's like, "Thank you so much for playing our game."
the tiny little pixie man of a cop who's like, you can't even see him over the top screen because he's so small.
It's like horrific acting. They're like, "Take him away," and he's like, "Yes, sir." Mr. Caffeine, like beams in.
Poop on your toothpaste. I'm the mean mom. But yeah, it is kind of crazy as well that both games were published by Monstrous, or developed and published by Monstrous entities such as Ubisoft Montreal. No, well, Ubisoft in general, and Team Bandai, and I guess
and Rockstar yeah. published.
Yeah,
Noir.
That's capitalism for you. But yeah, that's about it. You can go. The case has to be dismissed because I accidentally sat on my gun and blew my bum off. So I gotta go get that checked out. But yeah, that's about it on the old noir. One of them has an E and one of them doesn't. I assume that's a French thing.
Fantastic. Well, yeah. where can we find more content that will blow your bum off, David?
You can tell the mystery of FredNamush.com with the podcast and the condensed truth, which, by the way, X-Files content coming soon here because I want to play that X-Files game on PS2.
I did see that image you sent of your Steam Deck. Scully, you ever heard of the X-Files, Alien?
You mean my PS2 that I'm definitely playing it on.
Yes. Yeah. Your portable PS2 project that you got from some guy online. I really want to talk about like weird
those
videos together like... handhelds.
yeah.
The fucking Wii that somebody put in a mint in. Anyway, that's way off topic.
Science went too far. And also FEWB18. But what about you?
I am Sammy_Crow. And we've Gamer Era podcast is moving out across the metaverse. It's on Twitter. It's on Blue Sky. Now everyone can come to Blue Sky. Everyone is here.
Everyone can
you can join the tens of followers that we have on that platform. We did actually recently get a re-skeet or a fave. I don't know what they call them over there. On one of our Playdate episode from the Hello Playdate podcast, which was very, very dear to me because I love that podcast. And I want to return to Playdate at some point because the segment I hosted before was basically just me describing games, which didn't make a very compelling segment. It was very Abe Simpson describing Thomas Edison on the radio. Just, see, would follow.
Too many toasters.
Keep gaming.
It's got nothing on Mario Strikers, though, so...
Oh, God, yeah, we were going to talk about Mario Strikers when we were going to do that Mario podcast idea. One day we will talk about Mario Strikers.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Shy guy. And the Garfield, yes. Oh, Luigi activated his power-up.
Some anti-football gloves and drugs. God.